Mystic Fire Audio, in association with Sound Horizons Audio Video Incorporated, presents Quantum Healing Workshop with Deepak Chopra. This is the first of four tapes.
Now, this seminar is called Quantum Healing, but it is really based on Ayurveda, and it is based on one particular brand of Ayurveda. It's called Maharishi Ayurveda. And that is because everything I have learnt and the framework that I'm going to give you today comes from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the same person who introduced Transcendental Meditation to the world. So this morning, let's just spend a couple of hours, or up to about 12:15 or so, talking about the quantum mechanical body and the quantum mechanical mind. Yesterday I was at a conference in Boston with Fritjof Capra and Candice Pert, and we spent the whole morning just trying to define what mind is. We all talk about the mind-body connection. We all talk about the fact that the mind influences the body and so on, but I think whilst we can talk of all the practical implications of this, it's more important for us now to really understand what is this thing that we call mind. Fritjof Capra, whom I'm sure you know of, said yesterday, he said, we're in the midst of a crisis of perception today in the world, and there's a paradigm shift going on where we are changing our entire worldview. And this worldview comes about as a result of this crisis of perception. And this is what I'd like to address now, the mechanics of perception, because after all, our entire reality is structured as a result of our sensory experiences. What we call real is structured out of our sensory experiences. And we have relied all along on our sensory experiences as the crucial test, for what is real. The expression is, if you can see it, then you can believe it. If you can touch it, then it's there. And the crisis of perception today is that that may not necessarily be the case. Let's look at the mechanism of perception and how we really create what we call the material universe. There's an interesting experiment that you can do. You can take some flies and put them in a big jar like this and put a lid over the jar. And you do that for a couple of days and then you remove the lid. And you'll find that 99.9% of the flies won't be able to get out of this jar, even though there's no lid now at the top. As a result of that initial sensory experience, the flies and their body mind, whatever that is, we'll come to it in a moment, have structured a commitment to themselves that this is the limit of the universe. So they can never escape from it, except for a couple of pioneers who can manage to get out. In India, when they train elephants, they do a very interesting thing. They take a baby elephant and they tie it with a flimsy rope to a small plant, something like a little Christmas tree, and they do that for a few weeks. And then when that elephant grows up to be a big, huge animal, you can now tie the elephant with an iron chain to a tree, and it will snap the iron chain with one movement, or better still, sometimes walk away with the tree. But if you take that flimsy rope, that same green color, and tie it to the old green twig, it won't be able to escape. It's made a commitment in its body-mind that that's a prison. This phenomenon is being called by psychologists premature cognitive commitment. What's a premature cognitive commitment? It's a commitment we make in our body-mind that ultimately structures our reality. At Harvard Medical School about 20 years ago, a couple of physiologists did another very interesting experiment. They went on to win the Nobel Prize in Physiology afterwards for precisely unraveling the mechanics of perception. And the experiment was very simple. They took a group of kittens and brought them up in a room that had only horizontal stripes. They took another group of kittens and brought them up in a room that had only vertical stripes. All the visual stimuli were either horizontal or vertical. And when these kittens grew up to be wise old cats, it turns out that one group of cats could not see anything other than a horizontal world. Another group of cats could not see anything other than a vertical world. And it had nothing to do with their belief system. When their brains were looked at, they didn't have the connections between neurons to either see horizontal or vertical stimuli. They just didn't have the nervous system to see either vertical or horizontal stimuli. There's a scientist by the name of Dr. Edelman, right here in New York City at the Rockefeller Foundation Institute, who is now unraveling even more the mysteries of sensory perception. And what he proposes and what is being accepted is that our initial sensory experience and how it is interpreted for us actually structures a nervous system that ultimately has only one function. That is to keep reinforcing what was exposed to us in the first place. So what you see out there is what you were taught to see, basically. If you weren't told that it exists, then it doesn't exist for you. The nervous system develops as a response to sensory stimuli that creates a certain perception of the world, and that perception of the world then structures a belief system. After all, how do you make a belief system? By what you see and touch and hear and smell. And then the nervous system has only one function after that, to keep reinforcing the belief system. So right now, in this moment, in most cases, and I'm sure there are exceptions in this room, but for the most part, most people will take in through their nervous system less than 1 billionth of all the stimuli that are present in this room. Less than 1 billionth of the stimuli that are present in this room will get into the nervous system. And these are the ones that reinforce what you think exists out there. If you don't think it exists out there, then you won't even see it. So the popular expression, seeing is believing, is really not true at all. It's the other way around. Believing is seeing. If you don't believe it, you can't see it. You can't hear it. You can't touch it. You can't taste it. You can't smell it. Your nervous system has been programmed to take in only a small bit of reality. And with bits of perception, which is all we have, with bits of perception, we cannot see the whole. And that's the reason we live in alienation and fragmentation and separation from each other, because we can only see bits and parts. And those bits and parts have been structured as a result of these premature cognitive commitments that we have made. The human eye, for example, for the most part, can only see between 370 and 390 billionths of a meter. This afternoon we'll go over some exercises to extend that. But normally, the human eye can only see between that range. There's nothing sacred between 365 and 370, but as far as you're concerned, it doesn't exist. Of course, we have scientific instruments that will extend that. They're the prostheses of our eyes, but they extend it a little bit more. It's not reality that we see out there or perceive out there. The picture of the world is not the look of it at all. It's our way of looking at it, literally. The picture of the world is not the look of it, it's our way of looking at it, literally. Our way of looking at it determines its entire reality for us. Even different species perceive the world differently. Take a walk with your dog and you'll see that he smells an entirely different universe, hears sounds that you can't hear. A snake senses its environment through infrared more than anything else. A bat through the echo of ultrasound. The eye cells of a honey bee cannot perceive the colors that you and I see, but they can sense ultraviolet. When a honey bee looks at a flower, it doesn't see a flower at all. All it sees is honey from a distance. Misses the flower altogether, like we miss the honey altogether. A chameleon's eyeballs swivel on two different axes. You can't even remotely imagine what this room would look like to a chameleon. So what's the real look of it? What's the real texture of it? What's the real sound of it? The answer is, there isn't such a thing. It's infinite possibilities all coexisting at the same time. And out of those infinite possibilities, all coexisting at the same time, we structure a certain perceptual reality. And if we happen to agree on it, then we say, now we have scientific proof that it exists. What we call science is nothing other than a collection of our subjective experiences as a result of our perceptual reality. But that perceptual reality, whilst it's real on one level, it's an artifact on other levels. It's not the whole story. Sir John Eccles, the famous Australian, now Australian, formerly British physiologist, who also won the Nobel Prize, said, there are no colors in the real world. There are no textures in the real world. No smells, no beauty, no ugliness. They're all structured in our own consciousness. We create these through our own self-interaction. I'll go into the mechanics of this in a little bit. The fact is that the universe is made up of force fields and matter fields that ultimately come out from one unified field. Today, scientists will tell you that everything that you can perceive out there ultimately comes out from four basic forces in nature. Gravity, which makes the earth go around, holds the planets together. Electromagnetism, which we experience as heat, light, etc. Electricity, magnetism, makes the television screen work and all the other things that we have with modern technology. The strong force which holds the nucleus of an atom together, it's a very strong force, and that's why it gives you the artifact that actually there's some matter out there. When you disrupt that force, you get a nuclear explosion, it's so strong. And the weak force, which is responsible for radioactive decay and transmutation of elements. And that's all there is. Scientists now believe that these forces come from one fundamental force in nature, which is called the unified field. And we are part of it too, because that's all there is. Space, time, what we call the material universe, are structured as a result of these forces of nature breaking up and expressing themselves. The scientists call this process symmetry breaking, and expressing themselves as what we call material objects, separated from each other in space and time. But in fact, that is what we experience as matter, is something that happens only in consciousness. Out there, the world is just energy fields. And these energy fields are actually one field. Space-time are part of this energy field also. Somehow, that energy field is broken up through perception. We translate that energy field into our experience of sound, taste, form, color, etc. And then there's a process of labeling that goes on in our own consciousness. And then, voila, out of that energy field, we have this material universe that we perceive. But it's not like that out there. It's like that in here only. However, our whole system of science today, not science, I should say, because science has moved beyond that, but medicine today is based on this superstition. And the superstition is that the world is made up of matter. And that human bodies are also material. And the universe is made up of separate objects that have a relationship in space and time. This superstition of materialism literally is the cause of all our logic also in Western medicine and what we might call contemporary medicine. Our whole logic in contemporary medicine is based on this superstition that in fact we are physical machines that have learned how to think. For some reason, this dance of molecules in our body creates what we call thought. And it is the frozen sculpture model, we might say, in medicine today. If you can't believe you ate the whole thing, just have a couple of Alka-Seltzer, it will take care of the problem. Can't sleep at night, take a sleeping pill. All these magic bullets that we have. You're feeling anxious, take a tranquilizer. It's supposed to give you tranquility. You have an infection, take an antibiotic. You have cancer, take chemotherapy, radiation. You have chest pain, take a nitroglycerin. Better still, have a bypass operation. And on and on and on. We are still today searching for magic bullets. The latest search is for a magic bullet for AIDS. And there's a constant search for these magic bullets. But the whole concept may be wrong. It's based on the idea that the body is material and these material agents are the cause of disease. Scientists always try to understand the mechanism of disease. That's what basic science is about. What are the mechanisms of disease, and then how can we interfere with those mechanisms of disease so we'll prevent the disease from happening. And what has happened is that this confusion between mechanism and ultimate cause has resulted in the idea that we're actually doing something. The fact is that there is a great disenchantment even amongst the medical profession in this approach because it simply doesn't work. It's a symptomatic approach that doesn't get to the basic cause of disease. It merely addresses the symptoms of disease, very often masks the symptoms of disease. With tranquilizers and sleeping pills, we have drug addiction as a result of medical prescriptions as the number one cause of addiction in the world. I mean, every day we read in the newspapers about street drugs in Colombia and all the trafficking that goes on through Miami and so on. But just look at the statistics, published statistics. From 1962 to 1986, there has been a 300% increase in drug addiction as a result of legal medical prescriptions. In the same period, a 40% increase in drug addiction from street drugs. There's no comparison. Antibiotics today are the number one cause of deaths from infectious disease, not the AIDS virus, even though the newspapers would have you believe that. The California Medical Association just completed this study, sponsored by a health insurance group, which beyond all doubt shows that about 80,000 deaths in this country occur per year as a result of infections that are acquired in hospitals as a result of antibiotic-resistant organisms. And even in cancer, where we think we are making progress, if you look at the last four decades, the last 40 years, and look at the age-adjusted mortality from cancer, you'll find that it hasn't changed by even 1%. In fact, it has increased. So while some cancers are now, of course, curable, Hodgkin's and a few others, there is the emergence of other types of cancer as a result of treatment. In fact, there is fear in the immunology community that the most frequent cause of cancer in the future may become the treatment of cancer, because we treat with these very powerful drugs. They're the equivalent of nuclear warfare, literally, in our body, that destroy the immune system and render us more susceptible to other types of infection and other types of cancers. And, you know, I could go on all day about this, but this is not a seminar to criticize our contemporary approach. That contemporary approach is being questioned within the medical establishment now. And there are, in fact, a lot of medical schools that are addressing this whole model. The model is wrong. It's not that scientists don't have good intentions and doctors don't want to help their patients. By and large, most doctors do. The only problem is, maybe the model is wrong. Maybe this whole Newtonian worldview should now be buried as an obsolete model. Because, in fact, it is frozen in this very obsolete model. We are physical machines that have learned how to think. So I'd like to introduce you today to the Ayurvedic model, and also the model that is becoming contemporary as a result of insights from physics, also insights from neurobiology. And this model doesn't look at the body as a frozen sculpture, but rather as a dynamic dance, literally, of intelligent energy. You might say it is very close, in fact, to the old Hippocratic model and also to the Greek model. Heraclitus, the Greek philosopher, compared the human body to a river of energy. And he said, when you look at a river, it really fools you because you get the idea that it's the same river. But in fact, it's changing every moment. You can't, Heraclitus said, you can't look at the same river twice because new water is flowing in. It gives you the illusion of non-change, but in fact it's changing very rapidly. There's a technical word for this in Ayurveda, in Vedic science, we call it Maya. It looks something, but in fact, it's something else. Question the perception that fools you. It's fooling us all the time. Perception is not the crucial test of reality. Perception tells us the earth is flat. We know that's not true. Perception tells us that the earth, that the sun rises in the east, sets in the west. We know that there's another story behind that. And so on. Just like you cannot step into the same river twice, the real you, and hopefully we'll get at the real you today, this morning, the real you cannot step into the same flesh and bones twice. In fact, the physical bodies that you're using to sit on these chairs are not the ones that you walked in with a little while ago. If you look at all the processes that are going on, we can take only one of them now, breathing. With each breath that you take in, you take in 10 to the power of 28 atoms inside your body. With each breath that you exhale 10 to the power of 28 atoms. You're breathing out, literally, bits of your heart and kidney and nervous system and bits of your body. And we're sharing them with each other, well, physically speaking. There aren't any well-defined edges. We're exchanging our organs with each other and with the rest of the universe. In fact, mathematicians and radioisotope scientists have made astounding calculations to prove beyond a doubt that right now in your body you have 1 million atoms that were in somebody else's body in the last 3 weeks. You have 1 quadrillion atoms in your body right now that were at one time in the physical body of Jesus Christ and Mahatma Gandhi and Genghis Khan and Adolf Hitler, to name a few people. You have 1 quadrillion atoms in your physical body that were in the body of every other person who has ever lived on this planet. So how can you separate yourself from anything that happens in this universe? The popular expression in physics is when the electron vibrates, the universe shakes. And it's absolutely true. Radioisotope studies show that you replace 98% of all the atoms in your body in less than a year. You make a new skin once a month. A new liver every 6 weeks. A new skeleton every 3 months. A new stomach lining every 5 days. Even the brain cells that you think with as atoms, as carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, etc., weren't there 1 year ago. The DNA, which is the genetic information that we have, which literally has all the information of the entire evolutionary history of not only mankind, but all biological species. This bit of DNA, which encodes the information of the whole universe, the one that you have right now wasn't there 6 weeks ago. As carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, etc. As matter, it wasn't there 6 weeks ago. So according to Ayurveda, at least, if you think you are your physical body, then there's a bit of a dilemma here. Which one are you talking about? The 1989 model is not the same as the 1988 model, or even from the one 3 months ago. Ayurveda says that we are not our physical bodies. In fact, we are changing our physical bodies more effortlessly and more rapidly than we can change our clothes. There's something else that structures, gives the experience of the physical body. Something else that structures and gives the experience of the physical body. But that physical body is like this river that is the brand new river every time you look at it. So if we are not our physical bodies that have learned how to think, what are we? Where do we come from? And today, science is actually giving us some interesting answers. If you could see the physical body from the point of view of a quantum field physicist, you'd realize that it's made up of atoms, and the atoms are made up of particles that are moving at lightning speeds around huge empty spaces, constantly appearing, disintegrating, rebounding, colliding, disintegrating, disappearing. These particles are not material objects at all. Even though they give us the appearance of material objects, they are fluctuations of energy in a field of energy. If you could see the body as it really is, you'd see it proportionately as void, as intergalactic space. Each atom in your body is an entire solar system by itself. And if you could see it the way it really is, not through the artifact of sensory experience, we've established, I think, that sensory experience is not the crucial test of reality. If you could see it really as it is, you'd see a huge empty void with a few scattered dots and spots and some random electrical discharges here and there. And Ayurveda has a lot to say about this void. This void is the ultimate ground of our being. And this void is not an emptiness of nothing, it's a fullness of non-material intelligence. And that's who we are. That non-material intelligence that expresses itself as the material body. Material body comes and goes, but that non-material intelligence, that fullness of non-material intelligence, remains forever. It's beyond time, beyond space. It structures the experience of the physical body. If we could know that experientially, not just intellectually, because intellectually everybody is beginning to agree about this. All the physicists are beginning to agree about this. But if we could experience that, if we could know that experientially, then all the problems of living would disappear. Because we would realize that we are not really human beings that have an occasional spiritual experience. That in fact we are spiritual beings that have an occasional human experience. And that basic perceptual shift would really completely change our own crisis of identity, and would also completely change how we interact with each other, and would also completely change our whole universe, how we experience it. Is there any validity to this? Well, scientists are proving that in fact it is the case. Just yesterday, I was in Boston in a group like this, but it was a very exciting group because we had Fritjof Capra, who is one of the greatest physicists, I think, of all time. We had Candice Pert at that place, and I'm sure some of you are familiar with Candice. She used to be the head of molecular biology at the National Institute of Health. And more than any one person, I think, it is to her that we owe this understanding of what the mind is and what the body is and what the spirit is, if you want to call it that. Candice Pert will, I have no doubt in my mind, unless we have a very male-oriented, chauvinistic, prejudiced Nobel committee, will win the Nobel Prize in Medicine. She's been nominated already a few times, I think, but she will undoubtedly win it because of this absolutely magnificent contribution that she has made of how mind transforms itself into matter. It was about 10 years ago that she discovered the endorphins and subsequently the neuropeptides, which have now been studied by hundreds and thousands of scientists. But it was Dr. Peart who first showed that when we have a thought or a feeling or an emotion or a desire, that immediately transforms itself into a molecule. Initially, it was felt that this molecule was only in the brain. A thought became a molecule in the brain, and that's why it was called a neuropeptide. The word neuro pertaining to the brain. Peptide, because when you study this molecule, it's protein-like. It's like a protein. The technical word for proteins is peptides. And she showed that, in fact, these fluctuations of energy in that field of energy that we experience as thought become these peptides in our brain. So she called them neuropeptides. And this is how neurons communicate with each other. This is how brain cells speak to each other. Not in English, but in the language of these neuropeptides, these chemicals. These messenger molecules from inner space, which is what we are, that inner void, interacts with itself, creates fluctuations of energy, which we experience as thought, and then these intelligent bits of energy transform themselves into these molecules of the mind that are called neuropeptides. And in fact, these peptides are like little keys. They are like little keys, and they fit into the surface of other cells where there are little holes for them, like little keyholes. So you have a thought, you make this molecule, which is like a little key, it travels, and then it finds its keyhole, it finds its lock, it fits into that lock. And once it fits into that lock, then the cell has got the message. So these locks are called receptors. And there are receptors to these messenger molecules that exist in the brain. Now this in itself was interesting, but what Dr. Peart discovered, and other scientists then subsequently confirmed, was that there are receptors to these same molecules of the mind, not only in brain cells, but cells everywhere else. When they started looking at cells of the immune system, for example, which protect us from cancer and infection and so on, they found that on the cells of the immune system, T cells, B cells, monocytes, there are receptors to the same chemical messengers. In other words, your immune cells, which protect you from cancer and infectious disease, are literally eavesdropping on every thought that you have, on every emotion that you feel, on every concept that you entertain, on every desire that you have. Every little T cell and B cell is listening. Now not only that, the T cells and B cells, these cells of the immune system, make the same chemicals that the brain makes when it thinks. That makes the story very, very interesting. Because now we say that these immune cells are thinking cells. If they are making the same chemicals that the brain makes when it has thought, then the immune cell must be thinking. It's not verbally as elite as your brain cell in that it doesn't think in the English language, but it thinks. It has feeling, it has emotion, it has desire. It gets happy, it grieves, etc. In fact, many studies show that when people are grieving and the grief is prolonged, especially after the death of a spouse, after a long marriage, that the spouse then, the widower or the widow, have a higher incidence of cancer and other things. It's because the immune cells are also grieving. They have that internal dialogue, leave me alone, I don't want to be bothered. and therefore they don't take care of the infections and carcinogens that are floating around. They are thinking cells. They are conscious beings. Now, Dr. Pert and other scientists have found that it's not just the immune cells. Everywhere else you look, the body has receptors to these neuropeptides. You can't call them neuropeptides anymore because they're not confined to the nervous system. Your stomach cells make them. Intestines make them. Colon makes them. Kidneys make them. Heart cells make them. So when you say, I have a gut feeling about such and such, you're not speaking metaphorically at all now. You're speaking quite literally because your gut makes the same chemicals that your brain does when it has thought. In fact, it's usually more accurate because the gut hasn't yet evolved to the stage of self-doubt. It doesn't doubt its thinking. So your gut feelings are pretty accurate. And so too, when you say, I have a sad heart, you're not speaking metaphorically. It is a sad heart. It has sad thoughts, literally. So at least what Dr. Pert and other scientists who have followed her have shown us one thing, that we have a thinking body. That in fact every cell in the body is a conscious, alive, thinking cell. That we therefore cannot confine the mind to the brain. It's in every cell of the body. That's our first big leap. Because we used to think the mind is only in the brain. But now we find it's everywhere in the body. In every cell of the body, it's there. And the second big leap that we need to make is that you cannot confine it to the body at all either. It's in the whole universe. It's a non-local mind that gets localized here and there as the experience of thought. But in fact, the whole universe is a conscious, alive, thinking organism. And we are not physical machines that have learned to think. We are actually these thoughts in a universal mind that have learned how to create the physical machine. This universal mind, or we can call it non-local mind, and if you don't like these terms, you can just say the unified field interacting with its own self through a process of symmetry breaking expresses itself as the forces of nature. And these forces of nature structure the material universe. But these forces of nature are not just random forces of nature. They are not just force fields. They are fields of intelligence. They are fields of information. A few weeks ago, I was at the Soviet Academy of Sciences, and I was trying to explain this model. I was trying quite hard to make it appear scientific, at least. And one scientist got up and he said, actually it's very simple. He said, Einstein said, matter and energy are the same thing. We need to make one more factor in the equation. Everybody's familiar with the equation. E is equal to mc squared. He said, add one more thing to the equation. Matter, energy, information. That the field of energy is also a field of information. And that field of information is thought. When you look at an atom, it's made up of particles, but we know that those particles are actually probability fields. A wave is not so much a material object as it is a probability field. The great scientist, Werner Heisenberg, who is responsible for this principle in physics called the uncertainty principle, he showed that the wave is actually the statistical probability of finding a particle here or there at the time of measurement. So whilst the wave is a force field, it's also an idea. It's the statistical likelihood of finding the particle here or there. So these force fields are actually fields of ideas. That's why we have this expression in our language. We say some ideas are much more forceful than others. Because, in fact, those ideas manifest themselves as molecules. Our body is nothing but a field of ideas. The very word information, look at the word, information. It's the whole mechanics of creation, giving rise to form. That's the word, information. Transformation. One form changing to another. Where does this happen? It happens in that field. So, I think it is very clear today to scientists that thought doesn't occur just in the brain, it occurs everywhere. And the other thing is, it occurs everywhere simultaneously. This is even more intriguing. For example, when I have the thought, I'm thirsty, which I am right now, as soon as I have that idea, my brain makes a chemical called angiotensin II. It's the molecular equivalent of the idea, I'm thirsty. At the same time, my pituitary gland makes angiotensin II, which causes the secretion of another hormone called ADH, which is responsible for holding on to water. At the same time, my kidney makes angiotensin II, which prevents me from losing too much water, so you make less urine. At the same time, the heart makes angiotensin II, which holds on to water. Where does the idea appear first? Now, we have the notion that the idea appeared first in my head, because I had the thought in my head, in English, I need water. But actually that idea appears simultaneously in every cell of the body. Every cell of the body says, I need water. At the same time, there's no sequence to it. It's a field phenomenon. Where was the idea before? Nowhere. It was just a probability amplitude. And before it was a probability amplitude, it was in the field of infinite possibilities. That field of infinite possibilities became a probability amplitude. That's the idea, or the beginning of an idea, the seed of an idea, and then it became the idea. And once it became the idea, it was everywhere simultaneously. Nowhere to begin with, and then everywhere immediately. This is what spirit, mind and matter are. What you call spirit or pure consciousness is the field of infinite possibilities. What we call mind is the probability amplitudes. And what we call the body is just the frozen particle in a moment of attention. But we confuse ourselves with that frozen particle in the moment of attention. And hence the fear of mortality and all the problems of living. But that frozen moment of attention, that physical body, is just a masquerade. Because underlying that frozen moment of attention is the probability amplitude, and beyond that is the field of infinite possibilities, who we really are as consciousness. And the Vedic literature says, that's who you are. In fact, the exact expression in the Vedic literature is, know yourself as the field and the knower of the field. And when you have that experiential knowledge, then you will realize your true status as an immortal being. And it's a beautiful description. It says, water cannot wet it, fire cannot burn it, weapons cannot cleave it, it's without beginning, without end, and it's ancient, and that's who you are. And go there and find yourself there. And then you will have no problems. So, I think biologists, physicists, and people in the spiritual fields are now all agreeing on this, at least the forward-looking biologists, some of them at very prestigious institutions, are talking about consciousness and how it transcends its material expression. How consciousness cannot be destroyed. It survives physical death. And in fact, that's the source of all creation. The whole universe is this one unified field of consciousness. Interacts with itself, creates not only the physical body, but the physical universe as well. I think we could get a couple of chairs for some people standing at the back. No? Okay. Recently, biologists have found some very interesting clinical applications of this idea that in fact consciousness conceives, governs, constructs and becomes the physical universe as well as the physical body. Several years ago, a Dr. Herbert Spector, also at the National Institute of Health, did an interesting experiment where he took two groups of mice and he gave one group of mice some injections of a chemical known as poly-IC. The poly-IC is an immunostimulant. It stimulates the immune system. And then what he did was he had these mice smell camphor at the same time. After a while, the mice don't have to be given the injection of the immunostimulant. They just smell camphor and they stimulate the immune system. He took another group of mice and he gave them another chemical which destroys the immune system, cyclophosphamide. It's an anti-cancer drug, incidentally. So he gave them this chemical called cyclophosphamide, which destroys the immune system. He had them smell camphor at the same time. And then after a while, the rats just smell camphor and destroy the immune system. Now you have two groups of mice. One that smells camphor, stimulates the immune system. It has made a premature cognitive commitment that the smell of camphor means stimulate the immune system. Another group of mice that smell camphor destroy the immune system. In one group, if they are exposed to pneumococci, they develop pneumonia and die within a few days. If they are given carcinogens, they develop cancer in a few days. The other group of mice, you can give them any amount of carcinogen or pneumococci and nothing happens. What's the difference between these two sets of mice? Just an interpretation. Just an idea, just a notion. What that smell of camphor means to them. And means to their immune system. This can only happen if the immune system has memory, if it has thought, if it's a conscious entity. Several years ago, also a study published in the journal Science from Ohio State University. Investigators were studying cholesterol metabolism in a group of rabbits. And they gave these rabbits doses of food that was very high in cholesterol. But to their amazement, they found that there was one group of rabbits that did not get the high cholesterol levels, despite all the poisonous food that they were given. And it turned out that the only difference between these rabbits and the rabbits that were developing the high cholesterol and the hardening of the arteries was that the technician who was feeding these rabbits, instead of throwing the food at them, he would take the rabbits out of the cages and pet them. And cuddle them, and kiss them, and speak to them, and sing to them. Now, they did this study several times, and they found that you could give these rabbits high cholesterol, but if you did this, they metabolized it into a completely different metabolic pathway. As a result of that experience, which we can call love, if we are bold enough, then these rabbits, as a result of that experience, made certain neuropeptides, and they're not neuropeptides at all, they're immunomodulators, but now it turns out they're cholesterol metabolism modulators too. they shunt the cholesterol into a different metabolic pathway altogether. To me, this is a very astounding study. Heart disease is the number one killer in the Western world. And at least in this study, the crucial determinants of whether you have heart disease or not are things like touching and petting and cuddling and kissing. Does this have relevance in human beings? Recently, another study published in Pediatrics from the University of Miami, they were looking at premature infants. They call them preemies. And in this intensive care ward in Miami, in the University of Miami Hospital, they had two groups of preemies, premature infants, in Lucite cribs with little portholes. And about three times a day, in one group, an investigator would reach out through the porthole and just stroke the preemies. They didn't call it stroking. They called it kinesthetic tactile stimulation. The Orwellian times that we live in. And they found that if you did this, it's a strange time. You know, it's no longer legitimate to call stroking by its true name. God forbid, call it love. But they found that if you did this tactile kinesthetic stimulation, then per day, the preemies, the premature infants, gained 47% more weight. 10 minutes of this procedure. Study was published in Pediatrics. The conclusion of the article is that tactile kinesthetic stimulation is a cost-effective and useful strategy because it saves $3,000 per hospital admission, per preemie. You can discharge the children 5 days earlier. So, we are seeing, in fact, that sensory experiences, in fact, create the body. Literally create the body. Every interpretation that you experience in consciousness becomes the physical body. If you're going on a joyride on Magic Mountain in Disney World, and you enjoy it, your body makes a chemical called interleukin-2. If you go to the NIH and you say, I want interleukin-2, they'll say it costs you $80,000 per vial. Because it's a very powerful anti-cancer drug. In fact, it can wipe out things like kidney cancer and melanoma, recent studies show. But it's difficult to make, and they're still not sure of the right chemical sequence of it. But one joyride on Magic Mountain will give you millions of dollars of interleukin-2. But on the other hand, if that same joyride creates panic, then you won't make interleukin-2, you'll make cortisol, adrenaline, which destroys the immune system. So it's not even the experience, it's the interpretation of the experience. The interpretation is the molecule. The interpretation is the molecule. Your body is a set of interpretations made in that field of consciousness, which is who you are, so we call it the self, and how the self interacts with the self and interprets itself to the self results in the creation of the body and ultimately the creation of the universe. Recently, the HEW in Massachusetts, the Department of Health, Education and Welfare, did another look at what are called risk factors for heart disease. And they found out that the number one risk factor wasn't smoking, wasn't hypertension, wasn't family history, wasn't cholesterol. In fact, very interesting, most people who have those risk factors don't get heart disease, it turns out. majority of people who get heart disease don't have any of those risk factors. The number one risk factor was self-happiness rating. The number two risk factor was job dissatisfaction. You go on the street out there and ask people just two questions. Number one, are you happy? Number two, do you love your job? And if they can say honestly to both those questions, they're probably going to be all right. As an interesting sidelight of that study, it was found that more people die on one particular day of the week than any other day of the week. I'm sure you can guess which that day is. What? Right. Monday. What time? Right. More people die in the world from heart disease at 9 o'clock on Monday morning than any other time. Now, isn't that an amazing thing? As far as I know, only we as a human species have that unique distinction of accomplishing this very extraordinary feat. Presumably, no other animal knows the difference between Monday and Tuesday. What is the difference? It's an idea. It's an interpretation. It's not a material thing at all. If you were told this is going to be Memorial Day Monday, you probably wouldn't have that. It's just these ideas. The body is a field of ideas, of transformations that we create. That we create as pure consciousness. That field of consciousness interacts with itself, becomes ideas, becomes the body, becomes the physical universe, the experience of it. Otherwise, it's just energy soup. We transform that energy soup into form, color, etc. So we are the creators, literally. But that's what we've got to discover. That's what we've got to find out. Even our experience of time is something that we create. Of course, we all have the idea that time exists. We use watches to measure it. Ask a physicist. Ask a physicist and he'll tell you that there is not a single experiment that proves the existence of time. Sir Thomas Gold, the eminent British physicist, says the description of the world as linear time with a past, present and a future is a completely inaccurate description of the physical world, which just is. In fact, we create time through our own imagination. Where have you experienced the past other than in your imagination? When have you experienced the future other than in your imagination? The fact is that same unified field is a continuum of infinite possibilities that contains the past, present and future as a continuum of infinite possibilities, all contained in an eternal moment of now. Only eternity exists, but we break it up with bits of perception into our experience of linear time. Time doesn't exist as an absolute. It is an artifact, again, of thought. We create time by the movement of thought. If you were saying that no, time must exist, then you start talking in terms of beginnings and endings. But then you're extremely vulnerable because what was there before the beginning? What is there after the end? These are conceptual frameworks. only. The great physicist, what's this big book, Brief History of Time? Stephen Hawking, he says, the universe has no edges in space and no beginning or ending in time. That's how he starts his book. And that every scientist who's in the field today knows that. But we create time. We structure a perceptual experience out of it. And then we create a given reality of time also. Ultimately, time is also an internal dialogue. That's all it is. A few weeks ago, I took a flight from Boston to London, and I met an old friend of mine, and we were having such a good time that time flew. As he said, we were there in a jiffy. The flight was 8 hours, but it seemed like we arrived there in 20 minutes. We forgot to eat. We forgot to go to the bathroom. We forgot to rest, sleep. We even forgot to meditate. Sorry, Greg, I didn't mean that. What happened? Our internal dialogue of time flying structured a completely different biology, which has its own cycles of rest, activity, sleep, wake, appetite, etc., etc. But that frequency of self-interaction, the self interacting with the self, consciousness interacting, created a different experience of time. And of course, you have people that you meet every day in your life who say, time is running out. They look at the same clock that you and I look at, but it's moving faster for them. 10 deadlines, time is running out. Study such a person, biologically speaking, you'll find that his biological clock is also in the fast lane. Heart rate is faster, blood pressure is higher. Insulin levels are higher, glucagon levels are higher, growth hormones are higher, platelets are jittery, etc. They usually drop dead in their 40s or 50s of coronaries. Then time has run out. They translate their internal frequency of self-interaction, which says I'm running out of time, into the physical experience of time running out. Also, you know people who seemingly have all the time in the world. They have a completely different biology. Or you've heard the expression, the beauty of the mountain was breathtaking, time stood still. That expression itself is a clue to what is meant here. Say, the beauty of the mountain was breathtaking because breath came to a standstill too. We'll find as we go into the yogic, this afternoon we'll go over some breathing techniques also, but we'll see that breathing is nothing other than the movement of consciousness. And when breath comes to a standstill, consciousness comes to a standstill and time comes to a standstill. It's the experience of unity. In the Vedic literature, in Maharshi Ayurveda, we say this is the experience of samadhi. Samadhi is the experience where the observer, the observed, and the process of observation, and there are technical terms for this, Rishi, Devta, Chandas, they all become one unity. That's why we call it a unity experience. You've experienced it when you have a stunning experience in nature, or you've experienced it in perhaps a musical performance, or in a dance performance, or in the appreciation of art. In fact, the whole existence of art is to try and have this experience of unity. Poets, philosophers have spent their whole life trying to recapture one experience that they had. And then they write about it for the rest of their lives. Because once you've had it, you cannot forget it. It completely changes you. It's like a child being born, cannot return to the womb. This experience of unity, this experience where the observer, the observed, and the process of observation become one entity, this experience of samadhi, is also described as the experience of bliss. It's not happiness. Happiness is happy thoughts. It depends on circumstances and situations. Bliss is beyond thought. It's, in fact, the suspension of all thought. It is exactly that experience. The beauty of the mountain was breathtaking. Time stood still. And many studies now show that when people transcend, as in transcendental meditation, when they experience that, then in fact, breathing stops. It's the effortless suspension of breath. When we look at the ancient Vedic texts, they say, ask for a definition of bliss, they say, Yoga Vasishtha, he says, bliss is the effortless suspension of breath that occurs in samadhi. That's what it is. And breathing is the movement of thought. Just like thought influences breathing, you know, when people are agitated, their breathing becomes rapid, etc., irregular. When they are calm, the breathing settles down. This afternoon we'll again go over these various techniques that we can do. Just like thought influences breathing, breathing influences thought also. The two are the same thing. And in fact, time is nothing other than the movement of consciousness also. And we metabolize, first we create time, then we metabolize it, and then we structure our experiences of it. But the flow of time is a purely psychological event. And so is the experience of mortality, a purely psychological event. There are cultures in the world that have structured different experiences of time. Even Trobi and Indians, they believe in cyclical time. It gives them a completely different perception of the universe and also a completely different biology. In the Vedic tradition, there's an eternal continuum of time with cycles, some very small, some very large, and some eternal. But all these created as artifacts of sensory perception, which occurs as a frequency of self-interaction. So what I'd like to do now, I know I've spent a lot of time talking about seemingly abstract concepts, except according to the Vedic interpretation of the universe, what is so abstract is the only tangible thing, and what you see doesn't really exist, except as a probability amplitude that you structure through the frequency of your own consciousness. So if we can understand that the consciousness is the ground of everything, then acting at that level, we can really create different biologies, if we have the desire. The body is in fact a river of intelligence, a river of intelligent energy that's constantly renewing itself. You might say, well, if it's constantly renewing itself, then how come I have the same old blood vessels? And they seem to get older all the time. And you know, how come I still have arthritis in my bones? And if I have changed my liver every 6 weeks, how come the cirrhosis is still there, etc., etc.? And the reason for that is that in most cases, we structure the same underlying energy patterns that create that physical experience. In most cases, we structure the same flow of intelligence to give us that same experience. Psychologists will tell you that you have about 60,000 thoughts a day. That's not surprising. I thought sometimes I feel you have many more than that. But what is a little disconcerting is that about 95% of the thoughts you have today are the ones you had yesterday. So you keep structuring by force of habit, literally. If you don't believe that, take a piece of paper and try and find out 10 things that you're doing this year that are different from last year. Just try and list how many things you've changed in your life this year as compared to last year. You can list 10 or 5, it'll be a remarkable accomplishment. Most people will say, well, I lost 10 pounds, then I regained 15, or I started bicycling and then I stopped it, or something like that. So we keep creating the same patterns of intelligence through our sensory experience and interpretations that result in the same physical appearance of matter. But the truth is, it's not that way. When I look at a lung cancer, for example, on an X-ray, and I look at a lung, I compare it with a lung cancer 6 months ago, am I looking at the same cancer, physically speaking? No, because the carbon, the hydrogen, the nitrogen that make up that cancer is new from 6 months ago. If I have a completely materialistic approach, if I'm superstitious and my logic is embedded in the superstition of materialism, then of course I will wage a nuclear warfare against that cancer, trying to get rid of it because I think it is material. What I really need to do is exorcise the ghost of the cancer, which means I need to restructure the energy patterns, the patterns of intelligence, the memories, the cellular memories that make that cancer. And that's what ultimately gives rise to a real cure, what we call a spontaneous remission now. Nothing intriguing about it. We do that every day, in fact, of our lives. The human body turns over 500 billion cells a day. About 1% of these are mutations and therefore cancerous cells. We all have cancer cells in our bodies all the time, but we don't get cancer because the body knows how to get rid of it through very smart impulses of intelligence that transform themselves into interleukins, interferons, tumor necrosis factors, all these absolutely wonderful drugs that are made inside our own pharmacy. Our body has the receptors for these drugs, not because they had some contract with Hoffman LaRoche, but because we have the capability to make the most exquisite drugs that can be thought of. And these drugs come in very precise doses at the right time, at the right target organ. All the instructions are contained in the packaging. And all we have to do is access that pharmacy. We do it every day, unconsciously. If we could do it with a little more awareness, then we would amplify that, and then you have a so-called miracle cure. Nothing miraculous about it. It's only yesterday's miracle, but today's science. Absolutely today's science. So, the body is made up of atoms. These atoms are particles, which are fluctuations of energy, appearing, disappearing, colliding in an eternal dance of creation. And in fact, our body is proportionately as void as intergalactic space. That void is not an emptiness of nothing. It's a fullness of non-material intelligence which interacts with its own self and creates the physical appearance of matter. And although the slide says we are thoughts that have learned how to create a physical machine, I showed it to Maharishi, he said, that's not a good word. Say we are impulses of intelligence that have learned how to create the physical machine, because thought is only one impulse of intelligence. We have feeling, emotion, desire, concepts, ideas, all these are impulses of intelligence that structure the physical machine. Next. And this leads us to a new interpretation of the physical body. And you have this, by the way, in your handouts, so you can look at it later. But I think that's the most important insight we can make this morning. And that is that how we perceive something becomes all of our reality. This includes the reality of the environment, the objects of our perception, as well as the reality of our body. It's very molecular. And the first step we can do is to stop thinking and perceiving our body as a frozen sculpture, as matter. Because it is matter on one level of perception, but it's also a field of infinite transformation. It is information. If our perception of the body is only material, our experience of it will also be the frozen sculpture. We have now a new interpretation of the body based on the latest science, and that new interpretation will restructure a new reality of the body, because our current experience of the body is based on also notions, ideas, concepts that we have had about it from the old superstition. Now we can change that, and our reality of it will change. Just the new insight will change its metabolism. We call this Gyan Yoga, the yoga of knowledge. Maharishi again, he says, knowledge is the best purifier. Knowledge will change. Just having the knowledge will change. It's not necessary to make a mood of this or that and say, well, you know, my body is this field of energy and I have to start looking at it like this. No, no. The knowledge itself is the most crucial thing. If I know that the world is round, then I can go around it. If I think it's flat, I have the fear of falling off the edge into space. So knowledge itself is transforming. It will change its metabolism. We metabolize knowledge and we make it into our body. And science now tells us what the Vedic rishis have always said, that our bodies are not what we have perceived them to be in the past, all these molecules, or rather it is all these processes, and these processes are transformations in consciousness. Our body is information. The word itself, information, tells you how form comes about. And it's all these transformations. It's intelligence, it's the metabolic end product of intelligence. It's mostly empty space. And these particles whirling at lightning, dizzying speeds, this almost total emptiness, colliding, rebounding, disintegrating, coming into existence, are fluctuations and frequencies of emptiness itself. But the Veda tells us that in fact this is not an emptiness of nothing, it's a fullness of non-material intelligence. Purnamidha, purnamidham is the expression. Out of fullness, fullness comes and fullness remains. It's an ongoing process. In order to restructure these patterns, we must first learn to become silent witnesses of these patterns. And then our mere intentions will change this. And I can have a new knowledge of it in non-materialistic terms. In fact, I can realize that I replace 98% of the atoms, and all these organs, which I think are permanent, in fact, I'm changing them more rapidly than I can even change my clothes. All this body, which gives me the appearance of matter, of solidity, is really a field of transformations, which are frequencies of self-interaction, myself interacting with myself. And I can reinterpret it. I should realize that there's no wear and tear in the universe, only rhythmic cycles of rest and activity and endless transformations. When did the earth get tired of rotating on its own axis or going around the sun? Where is this entropy that we talk about? We create entropy through wrong interpretation. Because with bits of perception, we cannot see the whole. So we have to transcend. We have to go beyond the senses to comprehend the whole. That in fact, my body being part of the universe, there's no wear and tear, only rhythmic cycles of rest and activity. These are part of an internal biological clock. However, we influence that clock by how we experience time, which is also a frequency of self-interaction. We create time by the movement of consciousness. In fact, we could reinterpret our experience of time, which would automatically translate into a restructure of the energy patterns that create the body. This afternoon we'll talk about aging and how this specifically applies to aging. Time, in fact, never runs out because it doesn't exist as an absolute. The flow of linear time is totally a psychological event. In fact, beginnings and endings are illusions, as is linear time. And you can't see the whole circle. You just see this bit, then you see a linear time. But in fact, it's an eternal continuum. And these concepts come about as a result of not seeing or understanding the total picture. And we cannot understand the total picture through sensory experience because it only gives us bits and pieces of information. Go beyond that. We have to go beyond that. And hence, the whole idea in Vedic literature of going to this fourth state of consciousness, Turiya, transcendental consciousness. When I stop experiencing linear time, understanding only eternity exists, and start experiencing only cycles of rest and activity, then the experience of entropy in my body would change. This new knowledge, just these insights, will already begin to alter biological processes, because our current biological processes are a result of outworn ideas. The body is nothing other than a field of those ideas. Next slide. And this leads us to the basic paradigm shift that is now occurring in our worldview. And I'm giving you this paradigm shift from the Vedic perspective, which has already been there for thousands of years. But interestingly enough, it is the new paradigm also. It's the oldest paradigm and it's the new paradigm. Yesterday, as I said, I was with Fritjof Capra and Candice Pert and all these very amazing people who are very well known in science, and they all agree on the same paradigm shift. The old paradigm, based on sensory experiences, says there's an objective world out there which is independent of a perceiver. But in fact, we live in a participatory universe. The objective world is in part a response of the observer. The old paradigm says the material world, which includes human beings, is made up of clumps of matter separated from each other in space and time. The new paradigm says the world is non-material, composed of energy fields which come from one underlying unmanifest field. Space-time are part of this field. The old paradigm, mind and matter are separate, independent entities. The new paradigm, mind and matter are essentially the same. The field experienced subjectively is the mind. Objectively, it is the world of material objects. Again, in Vedic literature, we find this expression in Yoga Vasishtha. It says, I interact with myself. I experience it as my mind. I interact with myself subjectively. I interact with myself, and objectively, I experience it as the universe. And Maharshi likes to quote this very frequently. He says, I look far beyond the reaches of the cosmos, and what do I find? Myself. There's an interesting conversation in one of the Vedic literature between a disciple and his master, and the two are talking, and after a while the disciple says, do we live in the same world? Because you seem to be living in a different world altogether. And the master says, yeah, we live in the same world. The only difference is you see yourself in the world. I see the whole world in myself. That little perceptual difference. It's the same world. You see yourself in it. I see the whole thing in myself. Because that's where it's created. The old paradigm, the mind is trapped in the brain. Intelligence is in the nervous system, perhaps at most in the body. The new paradigm, mind is not trapped in the brain, even in the body. It extends far beyond the reaches of the cosmos. It's infinite, unbounded. It may find expression in localized forms and phenomena, but the whole universe is this intelligent field. When it interacts with itself, when it thinks, the material world appears to manifest. Intelligence cannot be localized, only its expressions can. It's a very important very important shift in this paradigm. When this morning I was telling you about Candice Pert's experiment, when we have the idea of thirst, it's not localized here, it's everywhere. Now we know that actually any value of attention when we have on anything, it's everywhere simultaneously. In fact, that's how we create our experience of the world. The physical world that we are experiencing now is a result of our collective consciousness. If we change it, then the world changes as well. Many studies now show that when large groups of people go to this level, transcend together, then the physical environment begins to change. Because we are part of a cosmic physiology. And if our physiology changes, then the cosmic physiology has to change. If our mind changes, then the global mind has to change. Because we are it. We are part of that field. So we can say consciousness is not the epiphenomenon of matter. It's the other way around. Matter is the epiphenomenon of consciousness. We are quantum events in the unified field, impulses of intelligence that have learned how to create all this universe. And therefore, we as human beings are not self-contained, but in fact focal points in the unified field, inseparably interconnected with the patterns of intelligence that pervade the whole cosmos, a set of relationships. That our bodies have no well-defined edges, we are not separate, our needs are therefore totally interdependent, we are a changing, pulsating pattern, a part of the whole process. Our body is part of the universal body, our mind an aspect of universal mind. In fact, the whole of Ayurveda is based on this one basic aphorism. This is in Sanskrit, yatha pinde tatha brahmande. As is the atom, so is the universe. As is the microcosm, so is the macrocosm. As is the human body, the cosmic body. The human mind, cosmic mind. And of course, in other traditions, other scriptures, we also read the same thing. As below, so above, and so on. That time does not exist in an absolute, only eternity does. We create time as a result of our perception of change. We metabolize our experience of time into physiological changes. Entropy and aging are expressions of the metabolism of time. How we metabolize time also causes the biology of aging. Maharishi once said, it's just a matter of shifting our focus of attention. If your attention is on the relative all the time, then you experience entropy and change. If your attention is on the absolute all the time, then the relative comes and goes, but you are not experiencing that entropy. So again, the old paradigm, we are our bodies, our egos, our personalities. The new one, we are not our bodies, our egos, even our personalities. These are part of the changing scenery. We are not the scenery, we are the seer. The Rishi, the seer who creates and witnesses that scenery. The old paradigm, it says suffering is necessary, it's part of reality. We are victims of sickness, aging, death, etc. In the new paradigm, we are not victims of sickness, aging, disease, or even death. The seer cannot undergo those changes, only the scenery can appear to do so. Popular expression, becoming more popular. We're not human beings who have an occasional spiritual experience, but spiritual beings who have an occasional human experience. So, here what I'd like to do is entertain questions, but I'd just like to, for the sake of completion, I feel I should quote two of my favorite people. After Maharshi,